Good evening. And welcome to the March 2018 meeting of the County of San Luis Obispo Health Commission. First order of business is, since we didn't meet last month, February, because of all our Monday holidays, we need to approve our minutes from our January 8th meeting. Any additions, corrections that need to be made? Okay, seeing none, we'll ask Jean to do her magic and get them up on the website or wherever they go from there. At this point, we have a lot of time for public comment. If there are any persons in the audience desiring to speak on issues other than something that's a scheduled item and are within the scope of interest of our health commission, I'd invite them to please come forward. Seeing no one coming forward, let's go ahead and start with our program for the evening. This evening, we're lucky to have with us Dr. James Beebe, who's our director of our public health laboratory, and he's going to give us an update on molecular testing and some new developments in our public health laboratory. Welcome, Dr. Beebe.
I'd like to tell the members of the commission about a very valuable asset for the people of the County of San Luis Obispo and how it's been made more valuable over the last 10 years. It also means I need to do a primer on molecular testing. So Dr. Winstead probably might get bored, but I will try to explain to you what we mean when we say molecular testing and how we've been using it. And hopefully that will help in the process. So define molecular. For us, it means to use nucleic acids like DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, genetic material for microbes in humans, and ribonucleic acid, which is used by some viruses as their primary genetic material. Use these things to detect, to identify, and to characterize. And characterization means finding everything we want to know about that microbe, including such things as its serotype, and even deeper identity, so that we can see whether it's the same one that's infected more than one person. And use of various types of molecular tests. And these are the ones, there's a swimmingly great variety of molecular tests, but we're going to focus on three categories. One is called hybridization, sometimes called probe, very common to call it probe, amplification, and sequencing. So, okay. How many of you have seen at least one Jurassic Park film? I think you have. All right, so we're talking about DNA, the substance of heredity. And I'm going to use this to talk about it. It's the double helix, the famous Watson and Crick double helix. And it is made up of two parallel and twisting chains of interlocked nucleotides. And they can be T's or thymine, cytosine, G is guanine, A is adenine. And they have a bond that stretches between them. The adenine always with the thymine, and a cytosine always with the guanine. And it's a very strong bond, as, for instance, much stronger than the bond between an antigen and an antibody. We can separate these strands, and it's called denature them, by raising the temperature to about 180 degrees Fahrenheit. Then the two strands separate. And that's very handy for a variety of things. When we lower the temperature, they very often will anneal or come back together, not in any haphazard fashion, but adenine with thymine, cytosine with guanine, right up and down. So, very specific and very strong bonds. And those things would make molecular tests so good because they are highly specific and they lock in together. Every test can have a false positive and false negative, including the ones that we use. But it's it amplifies the score. So we can denature these molecules and separate them apart and bring them back together. When we do hybridization, we do exactly that. And this little cartoon is meant to illustrate this. When we can take DNA, target DNA, which may be a mixture, and we raise the temperature so it separates and then lower it, and then we put in another molecule that matches some small segment but has a molecule that signals us like a fluorescent molecule, then it's going to be specific. This is a shorthand version of it. Some things involved, including separating these molecules out. But if that little probe can't find a specific segment, nothing happens. No signal. But if it does, there is a signal. That's one, is hybridization. Amplification, and my poster child for amplification, is polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. You may have heard the term. It's in the popular media. It allows us to detect extremely small amounts of DNA. Sometimes, on the head of a pin, 10 molecules for, let's say, Mycobacterium tuberculosis can be detected. And how do we do this? First of all, a gentleman won a Nobel Prize for his invention. It's very important. And the primary materials for this reaction are those nucleotides, A, T, C, G, ready to go. A template or a segment of DNA that we want to amplify, usually not too long. And then primers, which are single-stranded DNAs that are complementary to short regions on either side of the segment we want to amplify. And then the last thing is something right out of Yellowstone, which is a DNA polymerase that can take high temperatures, which was discovered by bacteria in hot springs. We mix those together. We denature. Remember, they separate at 94 degrees centigrade, which is 180, 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Then we just lower them. They anneal together. And then we can extend them with that polymerase, with that enzyme that catalyzes the reaction to add the complementary bases. So here's what it looks like. So we separate them, denature them. We then anneal them. The primers anneal to those specific spots, just like hybridization. And then we extend them with the enzyme that fills in between. And then we do the same thing over again. We separate, we anneal, we extend over and over again. So have you ever heard that expression, give me a penny today, 2 cents tomorrow, and how much will you be paying me at the end of the month? About $5 million at the end of the month. In fact, if you just extend it a few more times, I'm going to pay off the national debt. So it is a reaction that is catalyzed to go over and over again exponentially by raising and lower the temperature. When this began, it was taking hours to go up and down. Now it takes seconds. So we can run an assay sometimes within an hour and get a high quality answer for something as important as TB. And very often, those little colored molecules, we can watch them accumulate and see it in real time. So we'll be watching a screen, and we'll see the signal rise up to tell us that something is there. It's really neat. Now let's take the clock back to 2007. What was the laboratory doing at that time? We were doing some molecular testing. We were using probes to identify MTB, but we had to have the organism grown enough quantity. We had to have a lot of it to run that test. So it was culture, which takes weeks for mycobacteria like Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and related mycobacteria. So we need to have enough of the agent on a solid or liquid media to run that hybridization. We were also running an amplification test at that time for chlamydia and gonorrhea, for sexually transmitted infections. And then in 2009, we began joining one of our major networks. This is the Laboratory Response Network, where we were equipped with high-quality PCR assays as well as some conventional techniques to identify agents of bioterrorism. That includes the agents that cause anthrax, plague, tularemia, brucellosis, the toxin ricin, very popular with people who want to threaten other people, and pox viruses. Very, very quietly in the spring of that year, we joined the Laboratory Response Network. And believe me, there's a lot riding on when I was telling the person I report to, Dr. Bornstein, that we have a positive result for anthrax. Since that time, we've ruled out probably 70 or 80 culture isolates sent to us by hospitals because we could do that in the space of about 4 or 5 hours saying, no, it's not. As rather than people wringing their hands and calling public officials for days waiting for a result. The amplification test, we moved up to what we believe was a better amplification test for chlamydia and gonorrhea, and we also added amplification tests for TB. This goes beyond the probe for TB back in 2009, pertussis, norovirus, and very significantly, influenza, because that was the year of the H1N1 pandemic. And this is the lineup of those bioterrorism agents. Not everyone that we can do, but we actually, if God forbid there ever should be a case of smallpox, we wouldn't be able to test it if it clinically was, but we can test for a lot of other pox viruses and have done so for the community. We also have the capability of looking for something like chickenpox, and that very often is helpful to rule out certain pox viruses, as well as ricin, and that goes on. This is the Laboratory Response Network. It's a CDC-sponsored network of labs. We're about one of 150 around the nation that is equipped with these assays and others besides bioterrorism agents. In 2010, we went to what's called syndromic PCR panels. That means, for instance, there are so many different respiratory agents, viruses and bacteria, that physicians really cannot, on the basis of general symptoms, make any educated guess of what it is. But if we test for those, and that time the test took about 2 days, we could single out and get a good result for 12 different respiratory agents and 16 gastrointestinal agents. And it was the instrument actually had been sent to us by the CDC. It was sitting there in the laboratory unused. And we got it going and began doing this panel. It was not as quick as some people would like to, but it was specific. We could rely on the answer. And it had multiple steps that took time, extraction, amplification, and then a readout. But it was what's called multiplex PCR. And that those 16 GI agents, that means 16 different sets of primers and probes and nucleotides all in one reaction vessel. It's amazing that it worked, but it did. And we used that until recently. We also joined a number of networks. Back in 2009, we joined the Respiratory Laboratory Network, 24 other labs in California dealing with H1N1, and since then, seasonal influenza, and reporting every week. We joined the Norovirus Laboratory Network, famous winter vomiting disease. We joined MeaslesNet, and we're about to join MumpsNet. These are extremely important because these are highly contagious illnesses that can propagate very rapidly, and you'd like to have an answer, a high-quality answer, quickly, and we can. The Laboratory Response Network has dealt with others, and we had the opportunity too. We could select which ones we did. So over the last 15 years, among the agents, SARS coronavirus was handled by LRN, H1N1, which we joined. The MERS coronavirus, which became a threat to us, we chose not to because the possibility of us seeing one of those patients was so small, and that's turned out to be true. Ebola virus, we also passed on that too, for similar reasons. Enterovirus, we did launch an enterovirus assay. Not for D68, that's one that's done by the state laboratory, but we can detect it, actually by two different PCR methods. And our parade of chikungunya, dengue, and Zika, again, we chose not to. But we have an option is open to us to do if the health officer thinks it's important and we think that we can do it. And produce something that's not, and I don't mean to disparage colleagues in private reference labs, but these are assays that have been developed with some of the best expertise in the world, and we can rely on them. 2015-2016, we switched our multiplex assays to what are called sample-to-answer syndromic PCR panels. Right now, we added, and we also added the gene expert, which upped our ability to detect TB by PCR to 2 hours from basically an entire shift. The film array is our sample-to-answer syndromic panel. Again, we upped it to 17 agents in the respiratory panel and 23 agents in the gastrointestinal panel. They've become very popular with the physicians in the community, and which is good for us because that means they know where we are, they trust our results, and they will send us specimens for testing. We also developed reference assays, I mentioned, for enterovirus, varicella, and we have used them a number of times, especially in congregate settings like Cal Poly, where it's important to know quickly whether something is or is not. And measles, which we've used successfully for a mini cluster here, and we now have mumps ready to go. Very important. We also upgraded our STIs to add trichomonas to chlamydia and gonorrhea. And one you may have not have heard about, which is very significant these days, is called Mycoplasma genitalium, is currently in validation. And we'll be adding that. Then sequencing. This is determining the actual linear sequence of DNA. And you notice I showed DNA as a double helix, so you actually have to sequence in both directions. And this is challenging. And good gravy, 15 to 25 DNA extracts pooled and run in 18 to 24 hours. Each organism, 3 to 6 million nucleotide bases, and analyze the data. And very often, we have to work in an environment that we're not familiar with, which is the cloud. Let me just explain what we're doing. We have to culture the microbe. We have to get a pure culture isolate. But then we can extract the DNA, fragment it, measure its concentration, and attach to all the little pieces, which may be number in the hundreds of thousands or millions, a barcode, which is also DNA. And then we pool 10 to 25 different of these extracts, load the pool into a tray, put it into our instrument, and press the button and walk away. Not quite done. The instrument looks like the little one there on the left. They cost several millions of dollars 5 years ago. This one cost $42,000. The instrument allows each fragment to attach to a microscopic area in something that looks like a glass slide called a flow cell, then duplicate it into a cluster. And then when we make copies, we synthetically make copies of the cluster with colored dyes, they flash colors, C, T, A, G, flash those colors that are occurring, so the speed of light, photographed and fed into a sequence. Now there's hundreds of thousands of fragments. What do we do with all those fragments? We have thousands of fragments that are then read into text files that are uploaded to a cloud, and we have to QC them in the cloud, and then we have to clean them in the cloud, which means removing those barcodes that we put on to keep them separate. Remember, we're putting 10 to 25 different organisms in the same pool. And then we compare the sequences with other sequences. Then we have to assemble the genome, And remember, 3 to 6 million nucleotide bases. And we may have each area read as many as 30 to 40 times to get it right. And then compare the sequences in the cloud to other sequences in the library to identify E. coli, Legionella, you name it. Identification, serotype, antibiotic resistance genes, everything that's available. In the cloud, this is where we are right now. We're working hard on it. This is an example of the screens that I've been looking at because I volunteered to lead the charge. And this is what it looks like. It's called Command Line. Some of you may remember way back when DOS was the, and you had to go in and type, and God forbid you should make a mistake. Same thing here. It's using Linux, which is a friendly variant of Unix operating systems. And yes, the amazing thing about it is that you can do this entire operation with a linked series of programs called a pipeline. And one's running back at my office right now, automated for that entire pool of 10 to 25 organisms. So this is what looks like. It looks a little scary. It is. And this is what it looks like. I'll just show you up here, if I can use a pointer. So for instance, here's, here's the one we named 69, you know, number 69. We didn't use patient names, okay? And we're reading it. It says R1, reading the DNA in one direction, and R2 below it, reading in the other direction. And then the software that some of our friends, including the Colorado Public Health Lab, my alma mater, has been extremely helpful for us and other laboratories in California and in the West in bringing up their expertise in this area. Now, you might ask, why? Why all this effort? I'm going to give you a little example. One of our newest employees in the laboratory, she joined us last year. She's been working on a mycobacteria in the TB lab. And she says, I just can't identify it. I've been working on it for 5 weeks. Can't identify it. They're using methods, color reactions, what does the organ degrade, what does it build up? Can't get a straight answer. That's the reason for this. It's called genotypic versus a phenotypic approach that all microbiologists love and have used for decades. We're in probably getting close to year 50 of this discovery and really understanding of microbes. And now we have the full readout of the organism and a chance to compare that. By the way, the assembly of the genome has to be done with this black box method. It would take several lifetimes to do one organism by hand. So we have to do it this way. And there is always the trepidation of a black box, but we're learning to deal with it, and we found that sometimes we can have one or two black boxes together to see whether they give us the same answer, or three. And the organism, once we've got that text file of its DNA, and it's no longer DNA, it's a text file, it doesn't go away. We don't have to go back and grow the organism again. We have that, and we can try different methods to characterize it. I think I have one more slide. And this is what we hope the final result is. This is a little bit simplistic, but for instance, here's number 41, 42, 43, 44, a Salmonella enterica. Escherichia coli 0111, that's the serotype, non-modal. So it's reading this all. The DNA, it's all there. We just have to learn how to read it. So we don't have to do an exhausting serologic test. So that means potentially we get this information within a few days rather than sending the isolate up to the state lab and waiting a few weeks. Much faster for us to determine outbreaks, much faster for us to see the seriousness of the nation, and very often to detect outbreaks that may be occurring nationwide because we'd be in this pooling the same information. So this has been a short explanation of the asset for the County of San Luis Obispo, the Public Health Laboratory, and where we've advanced in the last few years. Any questions?
Commissioner Campbell.
So on the previous slide, I saw one or two lines that were NYSERIA. I think one was meningococcus, and I'm not sure what the second one was, 60?
Yeah. NYSERIA gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So NYSERIA meningitis.
So if you've got a college kid from a dorm with a meningitis, and they've got just a few cocci in their spinal fluid, how long would it take you to demonstrate conclusively that this was or wasn't meningococcus?
That's
probably not a really good example because I'm sure the Gram stain would be all you'd need. But.
You raise a really interesting question. Can we do this directly on the specimen? And the answer is right now, no. We'd have to grow it first. And if it was in a hospital, they would be growing it, and hopefully they would send that isolate to us. And then we can run this assay. What I hope to do, by the way, currently it's designed not for onesies and twosies. It's designed for a whole batch. So right now, the way it's currently designed, we need to batch because a single run costs $1,000. But if you put in 25 organisms, it comes down to $40 per sample, which for us is a lot less than the current effort we're making to identify the organism. So right now we must batch. It would be, certain ways it would be nicer, but I can see us probably running it in the near future twice a month, and for us being able to get all the organisms that were in that run done in that time period. In point of fact, for a meningitis, at least one of our hospitals is currently using a sample to answer program similar to what we're using on the device called the film array and getting an answer in the space of about 2 hours. So it's not only us, but the premium's a little bit higher for us because we really got to get it right. But these high-quality instruments are also getting into the hands of hospital laboratorians and doing something like that. So the prospects are very bright. And the future is what's called metagenomic, where we're actually working with the specimen. There's a little challenge. It's being done by some of the top research labs, including the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub in San Francisco, doing some amazing things. You got to get all the human DNA out of there, and sometimes that can be very technically tricky. And what's left may be the pathogen. We've seen some amazing presentations. That's a few years away from us, but it's coming.
I'd like to just add to that because I think Dr. Beebe hit on something that's really critical in our world, is the technology is the same, and hospitals and private labs are looking at it, as are we, and not only looking at it, purchasing it, moving forward with these kinds of advances, but our rationale is a little bit different in those two sectors. And so whereas a hospital or a hospitalist doctor is treating a patient in front of them and they want an answer, what is the bug, so that they can treat it based on what we know is currently the best treatment. We, with some of this stuff like intestinal diseases or even a meningitis, want to characterize that organism in a wide variety of ways so that we can look at the community's health aspects of where did it come from, where is it moving, who else has it, how did they connect to each other, the epidemiology. And so I offer that in case, we sometimes come up against it is less expensive to implement just the identification of a bug in some of the private labs, and we push hard to retain the important additional aspects of our public health laboratory, because once it's gone, then there'll be the recognition of, oh, right, we can't do these other kinds of analyses that only public health is interested in sort of monitoring the spread of disease, not just treating the patient. And so that's my little plug for why it was important to hear about what the public health laboratory is doing, not just with the advancement of testing, but why it matters in the population health world.
I have a good question. Hi. I have a question for you. I just got back from Mayo Clinic Medical Conference, and infection specialists discussed some of the outbreaks that's happening right now. And one of the things was in Nigeria and adjacent African countries, the Lassa virus outbreak. And as we know, the Ebola, Zika, everything else, you know, if it happens there right now, they're having an outbreak that we can easily also may be able to find them here, the patients traveling in those countries get infected. Now, what is, I understand you talked about one of the slides, we did talk about Zika, dengue, and what's the next virus, and Lassa may be our next one.
Could be.
So what is the proactively, because this isn't something private laboratory is going to do, right? It has to be the public laboratory have to step up and test it.
In many cases, it requires careful selection of the patient before you even do the test. Many of the tests I described to you have the greatest value when they're only tested, when they're only used for patients who have a profile that makes it worth testing. Otherwise, the risks of false positive become great. So that's true certainly with Ebola, it was true of MERS, it'll be true of Zika, of everything else. Right now, the only place that reliably can perform Lassa fever testing is the Centers for Disease Control. So they're depending on the entire public health establishment of the country to be well connected to the medical community, to find the patients, to get the appropriate specimens and have them tested. Could that come down to a laboratory of our size? Probably not. But certainly the state lab would be a candidate for doing that. Zika is a good example, because if you open a clinical microbiology text and look at that class of viruses, flaviviruses, it lists perhaps 100 different ones that have been identified. Why did this one go on world tour? And could another one occur? Over the last 20 years, we're seeing new emerging infections. It's usually viruses, not always. And I fully expect that there'll probably be another new one in the next 6 months. And the world is so small, so interconnected, that viruses can travel like they've never traveled before. And the public health laboratory network and the entire public health establishment just needs to be ready.
Thank you. That was really fun. I had a couple of questions, and I think maybe Dr. Bornstein sort of touched on this, but is there still a role for serology and culturing and things like that in the lab?
I'm sorry?
Is there a role still for serology and culturing, and those are still commonly done?
For example, the future of us is to be able to work with, as Robert pointed out, work with specimens. That's mm-hmm. not year that. And when we get a human specimen, it's loaded with human DNA. We're not ready to tackle that now, so we must have pure culture isolates. Mm-hmm. Right now, we still do the old-fashioned bacteriology. We still, in the TB lab, cultivate it, because we have to have pure culture isolate. The technology for us to do what's called the metagenomic approach and go directly from the specimen to useful information is not there yet.
Right.
So we still have to do it. Culture is going to disappear, though, I think more rapidly from clinical labs, especially the private reference labs. The skills are not going to be there, even if there's a reason to do culture. I think it'll remain in the public health lab network. Mm-hmm. That skill will remain there. But it's going to be harder and harder. The tools are exciting. They can do great things. But we still, right now, need to culture the microbes.
Great. What's the most common thing that you still need to send away to identify?
What comment? Send off comment?
What do you still have to send away in order to identify?
Oh, well, for instance, we're sending Zika, dengue, and chikungunya requested specimens. Very often they're serologic. And sometimes the molecular test doesn't work well because the bug doesn't cooperate. In the case of Zika, it's only there very transiently, usually in the urine and even less commonly in the blood. So then it becomes serology.
Right.
And it's a very difficult serology to run. So that would be an example of what we sent up to the state. And of course, if we have anybody that seems to have MERS coronavirus, they are set to do that. We desperately wish they were better funded and staffed, but there is a very dedicated crew up there of highly competent scientists that are still there doing that type of testing.
Great.
Can I jump in for a second again about MERS? Because I'm guessing that the average citizen maybe doesn't know what MERS is, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, otherwise sometimes known as the camel virus. We don't have a whole lot of folks from our community going to the deserts in the Middle East, which is why we haven't seen it locally. But that's an example of the kind of disease, that whole list that Dr. Beebe had up, whether it's pandemic flu or SARS or MERS or Zika, it's the disease du jour. Or do a year. And so suddenly it will leave the news, and everyone thinks, why did those people make such a big fuss? But they're still there. And we will still continue to see it. When a new disease like that emerges, it emerges with gusto, like Zika, but then it quiets down in the news, and yet you still have to have the mechanism to test for it because there will be cases that pop up.
Thank you. I have just one final question. You had mentioned earlier that the physicians in the community are certainly starting to use the public health lab and that. How do we get the word out to them?
We've tried in a variety of ways because of the public health bulletin, the laboratory messenger. I convened the Infectious Disease Forum that included a variety of infection preventionists and physicians and laboratorians last September to try to share notes on what we're doing. So I think a multi-pronged effort, a relentless effort to do that, and I also have one of my staff does about a quarter of her time is visiting and tries to get the word out. We're not as powerful as some institutions in showing what they do. We look every opportunity to do to let them know that we're doing this, and somehow word of mouth gets around. And I review orders, and sometimes I say, "Oh my gosh, who is this physician?" So somehow it happens. Hopefully, it's recognition of the quality that we strive for, and now the speed that sometimes we can with which we can generate a high quality result.
Good. Well, we applaud your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Some of us are eyes crossed, and then we have Candace, who understood every single word that you were saying. So, thank you.
I actually have one more question, if you could answer. What was the mycobacterium that your lab person was working with? Can you say?
We're just working on some sequencing with mycobacteria. We haven't done our first run because it's mycobacteria. The organism is built like a tank. It requires special handling to break down that wall and to get the DNA out. So we're hoping in the next run that we'll be doing mostly mycobacteria. Awesome. So we did the next best thing. We sent it down to the Orange County Public Health Lab, and we're waiting for an answer.
Good luck.
And that might take a little time.
And one quick question. Will you be submitting your slideshow to Jean so she can distribute it to us? It's going to take a little time to sit with it and absorb it.
I'm sure Dr. Winstead probably would spend a few classes giving you what I try to give you in 30 minutes.
Thank you.
All right. So our next couple items on our agenda, you'll recall from our planning retreat, we talked about the need to discuss preventive health care and some of the services that are available and what some of our consumers, citizens, patients, whatever, should be thinking about it. So Dr. Bornstein is going to give us a little rundown on the Affordable Care Act and the part that preventive health plays there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Chair and Commissioners. It's nice to be standing and before you with a topic that's near and dear to my heart. As you know, I think you've heard me say, out of every dollar worth of health care spent in this country, which is by far more than anywhere else in the world, we spend about 97 cents on health care of the sick, and we spend about 3 cents on preventive care. So if we could somehow shift that paradigm, we'd all live healthier and longer lives. But it is difficult for a very massive system of healthcare to make that kind of change. There have been some really good developments, however, with regard to the recognition of how important it is to make preventive healthcare in the form of screenings, counseling, et cetera, available. And so this is a great opportunity to speak to you on that topic. Now, do I have a clicker or... Sorry, I think it'll work better if I just... So what you're going to hear is sort of an overview of the United States Preventive Services Task Force, how they do their work, what kind of recommendations they make and have been doing for some time, and what the relationship is to the Affordable Care Act and how that has made those types of preventive services more available. Do I have to aim it at somewhere? I'm getting a clicking sound. Oops, 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 oops. Okay. Before I get into this, though, I just want to point out a member of our audience who had a big hand in my being able to bring this to you tonight, and I'm very excited about her having joined our health department 4 months ago, maybe a little more. So Laura Jameson is now a senior public health nurse in what was once our cadre of utilization review and healthcare navigator nurses related to the many thousands of, several thousands of people who we used to provide the cost of care for who were uninsured. So one thing that also happened in our department was when the Affordable Care Act came into being, we went from some 3,500 covered lives by the county to about 40 to 50. And we were able, fortunately, to retain one nurse position, which has been vacant for a long time, but I am very excited about this position to become our subject matter expert on all things healthcare, health insurance coverage, and patient navigation. And so Laura Jameson, as I said, who joined our department just a few months ago, is still in the learning process, but I was able to call her up and say, hey, can you get me all the preventive services that the USPSTF, which rolls off the tongue, provides as part of their recommendations and tied to Affordable Care Act. And she said, sure, no problem, and provided them all in quick haste. So I just want to welcome her and have you all see the opportunity to utilize that service. And we're really trying to get the word out. We get calls all the time from board members, from state and even federal elected officials or other healthcare providers, or the NOR clinic is, you know, how come this person isn't able to get insurance, or they have insurance and they can't get care, or they, you know, have a primary care provider but can't get in because, you know, so that's the kind of work that she's going to be doing with and for us. So I wanted to take that moment to get the word out. So on this presentation about the USPSTF, say that four times fast. It is and has been around, as you can see in the second bullet, since 1984. It is an independent volunteer panel of national experts who know their way around research. So they look at all the science that has ever been promulgated in peer-reviewed journals and decide what's effective and what's cost-effective in terms of population health. And you'll see quite a few examples of that coming up. They don't get paid. They just have the glory of being on this committee to make a series of evidence-based recommendations aimed at improving the health of all Americans. They do so in clinical preventive screenings, which is mostly what you're going to hear about today, but also some counseling services and preventive medications. And since 1998, they have operated under one of the 17 independent agencies that report up through the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. In this case, it's the Agency on Healthcare Research and Quality. And I realize I left off the word agency. That's the AHRQ. Sorry. Going the wrong way. Okay, so who are these folks and how do they convene? They're a 16-member body that has a chair and two vice chairs. They get this glorious honor of being on the committee by being nominated by themselves, by peers, or by organizations. But then they go through a rigorous review process. And ultimately, when it bubbles up to the level of the director of the AHRQ, then they can be appointed. They have to be, you know, reviewed for their body of work, where they currently work, their resume, and a whole bunch of other important screening processes for someone to become a member. They're also screened for any conflicts of interest because, things, you know, if one was a major shareholder in the Bayer company and one of the recommendations is that people should take aspirin every day if they have certain conditions, you know, those are the kinds of things that are also looked for to screen out anyone who might have a significant conflict of interest. They serve four-year terms, and they provide a mix of expertise from a variety of fields, and I'm not going to read these, but including all the ones that you see before you. So both on the behavioral health side, physicians, nursing, and primary care specialties. So how do they go about doing their work? Ultimately, the recommendations that they make fall into one of five categories. They're grade letters A, B, C, D, and not F, but I. The higher the grade, A being the best, the more rigorous the research has been that shows that there is clearly a benefit to the population in doing that screening service. So a grade A, high certainty that there's a benefit, B, moderate certainty, C, we're getting a little less, D, no benefit at all, and I is important. It really means we don't know yet. We need to do more research. So just shown another way to take that really busy slide. I wanted to just show you the grade schema. But just to, again, go through, A, is there's a substantial net benefit to people from screening, cost-effective years of life saved. B, is a moderate benefit. C, either some combination of small benefit or, you know, not totally clear yet how much benefit across the number of people that might be affected. D is zero benefit. And as I said, I is there's insufficient evidence. So the committee goes through four different steps before they actually get to a final statement of recommendation. And anyone can submit online to this organization a wanting a healthcare service to be reviewed as a potential recommendation. So they get nominations online, and they look at what they're going to take on in accordance with, you know, is it going to have an impact? What's the importance to the public's health? Is this something that's only going to affect a very, very small number of people or a lot of people? How does it fit into what we already know in terms of primary care services and prevention? Is there new evidence that has just emerged in the medical literature that we really need to take a look at? And then they draft a plan of how they're going to approach the review of that consideration with key questions. Are we going to look at the total adult population? Is it just women? Is it a certain age, et cetera? And then when they have that initial plan developed, it will be posted for public comment on their website again for 4 weeks. And then they take all of that comment back, and they draft an initial review and statement, looking at all the literature, all the comments, benefits and harms, and then they put out a draft statement at that point and give the public another 4 weeks. And the public is, you know, probably for the most part medical personnel who are deeply enmeshed in the subject area, but really anybody can comment. The comments are going to be taken more seriously if they're based on primary research than my mother, you know, had this issue. But nonetheless, sometimes those are just the right kind of thing to get someone thinking about something. Oh, yeah, we didn't ask this particular question. So it's nice that it has this kind of comprehensive review. And then ultimately, the group will go back to finalizing what all the evidence is. And as part of the statement, they will post all of the rationale that led to the final statement. And in addition to putting it out on their website or sometimes in the newspaper, if it's important enough, it will also certainly appear in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. So, what is the connection between the passage of the Affordable Care Act and these preventive care recommendations? Well, this one little section, so it's section 2713, which is about the number of pages of the Affordable Care Act in federal legislation. But there was this one little part. Everyone thinks about the Affordable Care Act was all about insurance, getting insurance, you know, the health.gov and the exchanges and Medicaid expansion. But there's lots and lots of stuff in there. And one of the important things that was really reviewed for a couple of years before it got into the Affordable Care Act is this requirement that all, and I'm going to underscore, private health plans cover preventive services with no cost sharing to the patient. So what that means, anyone who has Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aetna, et cetera, regardless of how you got it, through your employer, through Covered California, going to a private broker, all of those insurance plans must provide those services, the visit costs, the laboratory costs, the immunization costs, whatever it is, at no cost to the patient. Now, I underscored private because the government often says, do as I say, not as I do. And this would be a big ticket item for the United States, who pays for Medicare and Medicaid. And so instead, thus far, the public insurers are very strongly encouraged to do this. With more with health care plans, managed care plans, most have been offering that. But that's not true across the country, depending on the level of development of managed care or how, you know, financially stable the programs might be in different states, et cetera. And so instead they've provided incentives. You get a higher reimbursement rate from the federal government if your state Medicaid program, for example, covers it. So even though tonight I'm really focusing on the recommendations that have come specifically out of the USPSTF, I also do want to mention in that same portion of the law, there are a few other recommending bodies that their recommendations also must be provided at no cost to the patient. And those are the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. So I'll give you an example of that. The CDC journal that comes out on a weekly basis, it's called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Yes, I read it weekly. I know that sounds dry and dark, but it actually is one of the best ways of knowing what's coming out of the federal government in terms of recommendations about a whole host of things. And one of the, they are the ones who publish any new recommendations for Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. So some of you might be in the right demographic and want to know that they have just come out with a new shingles vaccine, and it is now recommended for age 50, and it's a two-dose vaccine, but because it came out as part of an ACIP recommendation, those who have private health insurance can get it at no cost, and that is important because it is close to a $300 vaccine series. So that's just one example. Bright Futures is a nice new name for those of you who have been around in the medical care world for a long time. It used to be called EPSDT, or Early Periodic Screening Diagnosis and Treatment, which really is a fancy way of saying well-child checkups and everything that goes with that. So if a child is found to have dental disease and they're referred to a dentist, that is part of their recommendations. I'm trying to think, you know, there's just a whole host of things. Lead screening is part of it. You know, pages of recommendations that falls in that group. And then finally, the Institute of Medicine has a whole separate list of preventive services for women's health, and I'm not going to go into that tonight. So taking you back to the grading, so a statement comes out for any preventive service that has made it through the process of nomination, agreed to do the research, agreed to do a review and preliminary recommendation, and then ultimately a statement. So one might think, well, why don't they just stop when, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere, it's not important enough, or there's no benefit. But in fact, this organization carries it all the way through a letter grade so that you can know what's effective and also know what's not effective. And providers then can use the recommendations to implement those things that are effective, and now they have to under Affordable Care Act, but equally important, not waste people's time, money, false promises on implementing screenings that are not found to have benefit. So with that in mind, the screenings that are required to be paid for have to have a letter grade of B or better, so an A or a B. And here's where I'm going to go through, and I know that your next presenter is going to have a lot of the same recommendations, but I'm going to sort of buzz through just really quickly, let you look at these, and I'm going to talk about each one a little bit more as we go. But there are 27 recommendations in total. They may be only gender-specific. They may have age specificity, but, you know, they're all manner of health care. So again, going back to behavioral health, colorectal screening, depression screening, you know, cardiovascular disease, cervical cancer, obviously just for the female gender, etc. And infectious disease is on the list. Prenatal screen, supplementation of folic acid is on the list. And so, as I said, I'm going to go through these one at a time, so I'm not giving you, you know, don't feel like if you, oh, wait, what was that one? Two slides back. Here, we're going to go into a little bit of specifics. So the first one is aortic aneurysm that can be a deadly phenomenon. The aorta is the biggest vessel that comes off the heart, and when it gets blown up and swollen so that blood is not effectively passed through the body, that can result in a fatal event. And so, and it typically is an event of older individuals and much more common in smokers. So rather than, you know, everyone running and say, hey, I want that ultrasound at 55. I never smoked and I'm worried though because my great uncle died of an aortic aneurysm. All of these recommendations have a cost effectiveness component to it. So it's this group, 65 to 75, who have ever smoked, who are at greater risk, and they should have at least one point in their life during that period of time an ultrasound to screen for this condition. Aspirin is known to prevent certain cardiovascular disease as well as colorectal cancer. And this should be discussed and recommended for those in the age group of 50 to 59 as a starting place, and only for those, again, that have conditions that would make it highly more likely that they would benefit from this medication. So at least 10, you know, they don't have a fatal disease, so it makes it worth it to start to take the aspirin, to take it for at least 10 years to see the effect and not have negative effects like bleeding, which aspirin can enhance. So this is testing for the gene that has become well known in the last decade or so for breast cancer. So anyone with a first degree relative who has had that gene found, and often it is found after someone has breast cancer diagnosed, and then they go and look, if is this because I have this genetic mutation that may have been the cause for the onset of the breast cancer. So, you know, sisters, mothers, daughters, etc., are recommended to have screening and genetic counseling for that genetic finding. This is more in the sort of counseling range and medication for taking a prescribed risk reduction medication for women who are over 35 who are at increased risk. This, of course, one of the most controversial. Do you start at 40? Do you start at 50? Is it every year? Is it which, you know, USPSTF is at odds with other bodies like American Cancer Society or and this became a really big deal when the law first went into place. So this 16-person body, or a bunch of geek scientists who reviewed recommendations and put it out there of their own free will just so that doctors would be doing right by their patients and doing the best that they could, suddenly became in the eye of the storm in 2010 when their words were tied to reimbursement. And so they have pretty much effectively weathered that, but not without ongoing political pressure on the organization that used to be all about just looking at the research and making solid recommendations. So breast cancer screening is one of the best examples of that, but there are others where, you know, the nominations started coming fast and furiously because, hey, we'd like you to look into this and pay for it and give it an A grade. And if you're not giving an A grade, I'm going to sick my senator on you. And so I just offer that as sort of the poster child, if you will, for what happened to this organization over the last few years. But anyway, they have stuck with every other year screening for mammography for those age 50 to 74. So other organizations do have different recommendations, and that's not to say that someone can't or shouldn't, depending on circumstances, get additional screening, but this is where the free cost part of it comes in. cardiovascular disease related to taking statins, if you've got also lipid problems or diabetes or other conditions that lead to cardiovascular disease. Cervical cancer screening has been an interesting one. It has changed quite a bit over the years. I know when I was growing up, it was, you know, every year from the age of 18, whether you've had sex or not, to have a pap smear and to be screened for cervical cancer. That was also at a time when lots of women were dying from cervical cancer. We now know what causes cervical cancer. It's a virus. It's many different viruses, but they all fall into this one HPV category, human papillomavirus. And so over time, instead of, you know, making the 75-year-old continue to have that annual pelvic exam and pap smear, which could be very unpleasant and serve no purpose in that woman's life in terms of any years of life saved, we now have a lot of new information that if you're not infected with the HPV virus and through co-testing, women can actually go now every 5 years. Which is not to say that they shouldn't have an exam. So let's be careful, because there are other things that the GYN exam looks for, you know, swollen ovaries, you know, other problems. But in terms of cervical cancer, we're now looking at recommendations that are every 3 to 5 years, depending on which of these categories that you fall into. Chlamydia screening has also become more better understood in terms of who gets chlamydia. And for the vast, vast majority of cases, they are young women, sexually active young women. So now in terms of annual screening, the recommendation at no cost again is for women who fall into that group. There are other women, you know, if they're co-infections like HIV or other diseases that may indicate that they're at higher risk for chlamydia, who also should be screened. In terms of the general population, this is the recommendation, is for young women to pick up silent cases. And chlamydia, as a sexually transmitted disease, can often be silent, and it can go on to cause infertility. And so that's why it's important to screen for it in asymptomatic women as well. Colorectal cancer screening, I've had in my own family, people have said, like, so why, you know, I have an aunt who's now 88 who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer in just 3 years ago. Well, got screened on the basis of symptoms, not periodic screening. But she's probably going to die from something else. So these are the kinds of really difficult conversations that have to happen in providers' offices. And these are the difficult conversations that happen around that membership task force, which is, okay, you've got 330 million of us. What are we going to pay for in terms of years of quality life saved? And so for adults in the 50 to 75-year age range is when we are most likely to detect silent colorectal cancer, intervene, and not let it progress to a stage that would cut, you know, years or decades off of that person's life. Depression screening is something that is recommended for everyone, even for children now. I don't have the EPSDT or the Bright Futures part, but that is becoming increasingly understood as to how important it is related to its own cause of loss of quality of years life, but also the comorbidities between depression and a host of other medical conditions that can ensue. Diabetes, asymptomatic adults are screened when they've got elevated blood pressure, and so that's one of the ones. Falls are for older individuals, and this is not gender specific. I don't think, I'd have to go back and look at the chart, but I don't think so. It's those who are still living in their homes over the age of 75 to provide counseling as to how they need to maintain that good bone health and not be a victim of a fall that can result in very dramatic consequences. This one I mentioned is a pregnancy-related relationship, but it's part of the U.S. I won't say it another time, USPSTF. So fortified cereals over time have become a normative thing because we now understand that healthy spine health is dependent upon the neural tube, actually, is not the bones, but the spinal cord is dependent upon adequate levels of folic acid. Gonorrhea screening is very similar to what I spoke of in terms of chlamydia. Hepatitis C, this came out about 3 to 4 years ago, and now you probably see it on television all the time. You know, lots of people looking semi-depressed and then happy because now they know that, they're free of hepatitis C, or I think some of those commercials are actually related to treatment, which is another important reason to be screened. You know, if you don't know what you don't know, then you're going to run into more trouble than if you can intervene earlier. So now that, especially that we have treatment for hepatitis C, it's important for people to know that they may have been infected back in the party days or when blood screening wasn't happening or other types of infections. So anyone in the baby boomer age group is supposed to be tested at least once to rule out infection that might have happened decades ago, because hepatitis C is just that kind of organism that can lay dormant in someone for decades. And so it's important to know your status. Similarly with HIV, and most, both for hep C and HIV, if you've ever had a baby, that's how most women have been tested at some point, but it really is for all folks to get tested at least once, and then to use safe sex practices and safe needle sharing practices or none at all or abstinence, etc. But at least if you know your status at one point, then you can gauge if you've engaged in any subsequent behavior that might have put you at additional risk. Intimate partner and elder abuse screening is also recommended for women. Lipid screening disorder, that's your cholesterol. So for younger men and women, especially if they're at risk for coronary heart disease, should be screening, and then all men who have much higher levels of high cholesterol rates. Lung cancer screening is something we get asked all the time. Should I just get a chest x-ray, see if I'm clear? No is the answer, but there is a small group of people who fall into this category, asymptomatic adults within the age group of 55 to 80 who have a 30-pack year smoking history and continue to smoke or have been smoking as recently as 15 years ago should be screened for lung cancer, and that's a fairly new recommendation. Obesity screening, you know, the first thing that happens whenever you go to the doctor's office, get on the scale, get your height, is part of that is to calculate your body mass index and then provide intervention through counseling or other types of referrals if you're really overweight. Osteoporosis, this is for older women who are at least age 65 and have a higher risk of fracture because of bone density loss. And counseling. So in addition to, we went through, hepatitis, HIVs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, all sexually active adults, even those that are at a different age not high risk patterns should be at least counseled about what STIs are. And then skin cancer counseling is, you know, SPF 30 and above. I don't care what skin color you have. Everyone can get melanoma, and that is a deadly form of cancer. Tobacco use counseling is now a paid service we provided in the health department. We have been doing so for years at no cost to our consumers, but now there's all kinds of additional ways that people can get cessation interventions. And this is perhaps one of my favorite because my group of health officers really pushed for this, which is to make TB screening in at-risk populations a covered service by recognition that if you test for infection, you can prevent, by treating in the latent phase, prevent active disease, and that becomes a way to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. And so that was proven ultimately to be cost-effective, and thus this recommendation. So here's a reference for you, and yes, Commissioner Campbell, we will have this available online. Thank you for always asking and reminding us to do that. It's important. And I don't know if you want to, Commissioner Sage, go first, and then we can tag team on any questions. And okay. Thank you.
So what I wanted to do is kind of follow up with Dr. Bornstein and go over some of the things that, from a Medicare standpoint, you know, years ago, for those of us who remember, in the mid-1960s, when the Medicare program was federally legislated and became a law, part of that program stated that Social Security funds should be spent only for the treatment of illness and injury. No prevention was allowed at that time. So it's taken a number of years for the Medicare program to get on board, if you will, and start to cover some services. But they do now cover basically the whole gamut of the 20. It depends upon how you alphabetically list it or define it. It can be from 25 upwards to 30 different things that they do cover it. So Medicare does now pay for preventive services. I think it's important that we make sure that our Medicare patients are aware of that. And in fact, CMS has a really nice little booklet that goes into covering many of the things that Dr. Bornstein just talked about. And hopefully our senior centers and some of those places where seniors congregate would make this available for people to look through. Because it tells you what age you have to be, if you have to have a certain diagnosis to cover for some of these things. But the way it stands now, CMS is able to cover preventive services through their national coverage determination process, which is basically a practice guideline, a type of thing. And in order for those to be covered, they do need to meet the criteria as being reasonable and necessary, for the prevention or early detection of illness or disability. They do have to have a grade A or B from the task force that Dr. Bornstein was talking about, and they have to be appropriate for individuals that are entitled to benefits under Part B, or the patient is actually enrolled entitled to Part A and enrolled under Part B of the Medicare programs itself. There are a few other instances when CMS will put on some additional preventive services through their regulatory process, but it takes an act of Congress, is what it is, in order for them to be paid. And they have slowly added them on over the last few years, and they cover nearly everything that Dr. Bornstein just went through. So I don't want to belabor the point and go through a lot of what she's already said to us. It is in the booklet that I think it would be good for our Medicare patients to take a look at. And they can download it offline too, or online too, if you will. But there are a couple of other things that Medicare does happen to pay as a preventive service, one of which is a one-time. It's initially called the initial preventive physical exam. We all call it the welcome to Medicare visit. Our patients are our beneficiaries are entitled to that, to have that once, with as long as it's done in the first 12 months that they're entitled to Medicare. Some patients have it, some patients don't. It is use it or lose it benefit. If you don't have it within that 12-month period, then you just go on to the next step, which would be yearly wellness exams. And I'm going to, before I finish, talk just a little bit about what that wellness exam really is. But basically, the patients are entitled to one initial wellness exam, and then annually thereafter, they can have subsequent wellness exams. So if you did your Welcome to Medicare exam, then you'd have to wait a year and have your first initial wellness, and then thereafter, and it's about 12 months. You can, there is some language that's way too confusing to understand, but if it's the end of the month, it's the end of the 11th month when you had your exam before that, you could probably be entitled to do that. But what we encourage offices to do is go on the Medicare portal and check eligibility, because it'll tell you the last time the patient had this exam or this service from somebody else, so you know if you can be paid for it or not. It does the abdominal aortic aneurysm screening, as Dr. Bornstein talked about, the alcohol misuse screening and counseling. They list that as one benefit, but if your screening is positive, then you're entitled to visits. Basically, you're entitled to 4 attempts in a year, but each attempt is 4 visits themselves, so there are a number of different visits that could be paid for that. They do cover the bone mass measurement, the cardiovascular disease, the behavioral therapy, which is the counseling, not the testing necessarily, but the counseling, the same cardiovascular screenings, which is our cholesterol, our lipids, our triglycerides. Sometimes our patients misunderstand that if you have one of these things already, then you're not going to need to be screened. You need to be treated, and so there is a differential there. Colorectal cancer screenings, there are 4 different types of service that they cover there. There are some age limits and some time frames that are associated with those. We divide our patients into regular risk and high risk with colorectal cancer, and high risk can have it more often, obviously, than lower risk patients. The depression screening was put in about 5 or 6 years ago. This does need to be done by the primary care physician. Diabetes screening, the same that Dr. Bornstein went over there. Diabetes self-management training, once you are diagnosed with diabetes, you're entitled as a preventive service to go through this self-management training. It sometimes is done in your physician's office, but the physicians do have to register with CMS to be a qualified provider for this, and very often then it's done by your registered dietitian or who. Sometimes it's done out in the community at one of the hospitals also. Then there's a whole group of things that fall under the immunizations, one of which is a flu shot. Flu shot, every single year you're entitled to one. The way Medicare defines it, it's every flu season, not necessarily annually, and time frames are not to that, but it's a flu season. They do glaucoma testing as well. Again, this is a screening service, so it's before you've been diagnosed as having glaucoma. Once you do that, then you go to your ophthalmologist and you use your eye drops and whatever. Hepatitis B vaccine is one that's covered. Hepatitis C screening is done. So again, that's one of the things that over the last couple of years, all providers have been encouraged to please, please, please start screening with this, as the HIV screening is there as well. The lung cancer screening also, and I think Medicare in their benefit defines that you have to have smoked 100 cigarettes, at least 100 cigarettes in your lifetime. Not that I don't know if people count what they do or not. Or they also define it as so many years of a pack a day. Mammograms are covered. The age is pretty wide range from Medicare's standpoint, although do remember that while most of our Medicare beneficiaries are 65 and older, we do have patients younger than 65 who are entitled to Medicare benefits. Medical nutrition therapy services are covered. This is diagnosis related, though. You have to have diabetes. You have to have kidney failure. and they're a kidney failure but not under dialysis, and a couple of other diagnoses to qualify for this. The obesity screening and counseling is all in one category under Medicare's benefit, but again, if you screen positive, then you're entitled to counseling. Counseling is a number of visits throughout the year, and then it does reach a point where if you have success, then you're entitled to some more visits. But we do have to see some success there at some point. The pap test and pelvic exam, which includes a breast exam as well, is covered as a service. Our pneumonia vaccines are covered one time, and then if it's been 11 months since your last vaccine, you can have a second type of vaccine there. Prostate cancer screening, there are three or four different types of services that are covered under that. The sexually transmitted infection screening and counseling is a, from a Medicare standpoint, a fairly new benefit, maybe only 5 years or so that we've had that. Smoking and tobacco cessation, again, the tobacco cessation is broken down into, you can do four attempts within a year's time, and then there are a number of different things that fall into that. So as you can see, they cover nearly all of the things that Dr. Bornstein talked about, with a couple of things that are probably aren't appropriate to the population that Medicare generally covers. I did want to say just one little thing about the annual wellness visit. This is sometimes, I find in my work with physician practices, this misunderstood by our Medicare population. Remember, one of the things Dr. Bornstein talked about was the fall assessment, or the risk for fall. While that's not a benefit itself under Medicare's list, it is part of the annual wellness visit. So the Medicare beneficiary entitled to this annual wellness visit yearly after they do their initial and then their subsequent one. And it's really a visit that's geared towards keeping them healthy rather than a head-to-toe physical of what may or may not be wrong with them. So it includes that you have to do a health risk assessment. That's where they look at the falls and are they taking their medication and do they have somebody at home or wear a life bracelet or you know, those types of things. So the Medicare patient generally can either go online and complete one of those health risk assessments, print it off and take it in with you. That's what I do when I go for mine. Or the staff member at the office, because, you know, sometimes people are confused about going online or they think they really can't do, but it's really quite easy. So the staff will help them fill that out as far as that goes. They have to do a screen for depression, even though depression screening is a separate benefit itself. You could screen for depression several times throughout the year. If the, you know, patient comes in and there's been a change or something, you could certainly do that. But depression screen is part of this annual wellness visit again. Then there is a minimal physical exam that needs to be done, like the vital signs and some of those things. But I think even more important, some of the things it requires is you have to tell the Medicare patients about what their preventive services are, and you have to do a five-year plan for them about when they should get this one, when they should get that one. You have to, in the subsequent exams, check and see if they've done that or if they're overdue for that or whatever. You have to reconcile their medications every single year. Not that physicians don't pretty much do that every single time they come in anyway. You also have to, from a coordination of care standpoint, you have to keep a list of every single provider that this Medicare patient has, whether it's in the community or neighboring community or whatever. So you're really looking at the overall patient itself and trying to keep them on the straight and narrow, as we say, and keep them healthy there. So sometimes our patients are a little confused about that. They're expecting to go in and say, all right, completely undressed, put the gown on that opens down the front or the back, and they're going to have a head-to-toe physical. And that's really not what that is. Some of the physicians that I work with actually send a little letter out to the patient at the time that they make their appointment explaining what they need to bring with them and what it is that they're going to be doing there. But for the most part, Medicare has stepped up to the plate. It does cover most of the preventive services, and I think our Medicare patients are happy about that. So I wanted to take a half a second before we finish today to talk about another Medicare thing that's not necessarily preventive related, but Medicare patients are getting new Medicare cards this year. Under MACRA, it mandated that Social Security numbers had to come off of the cards. So we are now about to embark upon the first phase of sending out the cards to all of these patients, which just means for our physicians' offices, their phones are going to ring more than ever. But they're doing it in a phased effort, so they don't. It's not really mandatory that they use that number and that number only until the beginning of 2020, but we basically have a year and a half to get ready for it or whatever. California happens to be in the phase one, stage two of phase one for getting our cards, which means that our people in California will have their cards by the 1st of July of this year. So we will be one of the first states to receive those cards. They look just like the old card, red, white, and blue. Their effective dates will not change at all. This is an issue for our Medicare patients. A new card, they're thinking now, are they going to have the same benefits that they did? Their effective dates will remain the same. If you became effective in 1970, yes, still are effective. And as of 1970, their benefits haven't changed at all. It's just the number itself that will change. It is a, I forget what they call it, but it's basically it's a randomly selected number. It comes out of a computer system somehow, and it's numeric and alpha as well. The same number of digits. It's not a great big computer issue from a lot of our systems in that, but we do want our Medicare patients to be aware of that. And again, I hope our area agency on aging and our senior centers and maybe even some of our congregate meal centers in that are reminding the patients that this is, it's just normal, it's going to happen, and we all are going to get a new card. And that's what I have.
So are you going to warn the doctor's offices about that?
I have, yes.
And it's going to be CMS, it's going to be a big deal when people check in to see their doctor.
Oh, it is, yes. And the doctor's office have to decide how they're going to do it. Are you just going to collect the cards and keep them and then put them into your computer system all at once or whatever? The good thing is they have the same number of characters that the old one did, so there shouldn't be a big change. But CMS has a number, actually they did a pretty good job of this. They have some tear-off flyers that you can get for nothing from CMS, and I've been telling my physician clinics and clients and what have you, get a bunch of those and start handing them out to the patients. Some of them have been printing notices on the bottom of their statements that go out to the patients, although when you do that, as I tell them, you only reach those that owe you a bill at that point. There are some posters that are available from CMS, again, at no charge, that senior centers have been hanging up and you know, making it visible. So there are stuff, there is stuff out there warning our patients about that, but you know, we're still going to have lots of questions and there's going to be some concerns because we're all used to, you get your Medicare card and then you, first of January, you don't get a new health card every year. Once you're effective for Medicare, pretty much you're effective for Medicare forever, unless you go to like a Part C plan or something like that.
Thank you very much, Dr. Borenstein and Commissioner Sage, for doing this presentation. It makes our job out there on the primary care so much easier if our patient demographics understand what the preventive care is. I just want to add, we do have populations who do not qualify for SANCAL because they make a little more money than what SANCAL qualification is, but they cannot afford to pay for private insurance that's offered through ACA or on their own because it's too expensive for them. For those patient demographics, I still want them to come in for a cancer detection program. That's it's a public program they can sign up. It'll cover breast cancer mammogram. It'll cover mammogram, which is number one detected cancer for women, and also will cover pap smear. And also those of people who are over 50 and they cannot afford colonoscopy on their own, they can still come in and we can order a FIT test, which is a lot more cost effective. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Gina. And also, I think in our county, we're very fortunate that we do have a couple of other programs, like CAPSLO has that 40 Wonderful program yet that does do some preventive screenings and services. And I think they could also go to the NOR clinic, could they not, Penny? They could go to the NOR clinic and get that. But it's nice to know that they could come to any of the CHCs, right? You know.
I didn't see shingles on the Medicare list. Is that
well, the reason it's not on that list, Medicare does cover it, but it is now a Part D, a pharmacy service, rather than a Part D. But yes, they do the zoster.
And I have a question for you, Dr. Borenstein, about the shingles shot. So when you said that there's a new recommendation or a new shot, is that what you were saying?
It's a new product, actually.
So if you've already had the shingles shot, you should be getting another one?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's easy.
And is it's a two dose, the new one, and separated by 6 months, and is shown to be more effective, and therefore those who have had a previous shingles shot should still get this new version of it.
And it's been released? It's out there.
So, Dr. Borenstein, they get it at the pharmacy or public health, either one, is that?
I don't know if we have it yet. This is hot off the press news. I know we'll be ordering it, and I know we've developed our policy around it. And similarly, private providers may be just in the process of gearing up. So if you can't get it tomorrow, try back in a month.
So most of the private providers actually don't do it any longer because they don't get, for Medicare at least, they don't get paid for it because of it being a Part D benefit versus the other. And of course, one of the issues for the private providers also is it's very expensive. The other one had fairly short shelf life, if you will. The issue was purchasing and then not being able to use all of that. I'm glad that public health is going to be offering
it. And you're right that pharmacies more and more are becoming the place that people go for their vaccinations. So I suspect that they will also
because you get a $5 coupon to spend in the pharmacy if you get your shot.
So does it have a new name or?
I have it. It's called Shingalex.
I was going to say, I know there's a new
Shingalex
in the coding system. They developed a new code for it. But.
Yeah, Shingrix. It's a two dose, and it is not a live vaccine. And that's another thing is that Joster is a live vaccine. So this one is not.
Doesn't frozen
It doesn't have to be exactly. Yeah, and has it's a lot more effectiveness, way more effective. All age groups, actually, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other? I think I'm next up. Is that correct? I'll just go jump right into my monthly report. Thank you. So you may have heard, seen, read about the changes. This has been a process of working through with county administration, county sheriff's office. Oh, I did.
I didn't know
if
Evelyn knew that
before. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, sorry. I thought I pointed her out as the person I was speaking of. So now you know that. One commissioner asked.
Thank you for coming. We look forward to working with you.
Sorry. You mean you didn't get my hand wave in that direction as that's Laura? Yeah. This is the commission. This is Miss Laura Jameson. Thanks. Sorry, Commissioner Raymond. Nothing like trying to slip out, huh? No. Anyway, so okay, I am telling you that the jail medical and behavioral health services are in the process of moving to the sheriff's office, and the first step has occurred, which is that a chief medical officer has been hired who started today. Today happens to have been my wonderful deputy health officer, but we're not going to go there. So anyway, I am looking for a new deputy health officer, but I actually think that this is a really good thing. One of the issues that has been ever present is not having all of the infrastructure under one umbrella. And so regardless of who actually provides the care, it is more normative across the state for the sheriff's departments to have day-to-day responsibility for the provision of care. So that change has happened in terms of the chief medical officer, and we're working toward making all the administrative changes for the whole cadre of staff to move from the health agency to the sheriff's department. So I also wanted to mention that the week of April 2nd through 7th is National Public Health Week, and we have a number of activities that we are working on during that period of time. The primary public interfacing one will be our presence at the farmers market, where we're not going to be just handing out brochures, but we're going to be doing fun things with passersby, including exercises and BMIs and a number of things to try to engage the public in healthier behaviors, etc. I wanted to report back to you. I've mentioned how our oral health program is exploding, and we went from a one-person program for the last 5 years to now having these two wonderful grant opportunities. We have hired our oral health program manager, a replacement for Dr. Fardanish, and that is Ms. Barbara Morrow, who has worked with us for a long time as a hygienist on a very part-time basis, doing some preschool screenings, and now she will be our new face in the community and facilitating our coalition efforts and working to expand access to care for particularly children, particularly low-income children. And she is already jumping into the process of hiring staff. We have one person selected for our administrative services officer who also has a lot of dental experience, so that's fabulous. And we have developed we did an RFP to get a consultant to take a fresh look at our whole system of oral health care, and so we will be engaging again with some really experienced folks in that arena, Dr. Kathy Phipps and Joel Dieringer. And we're in the process of hiring about four other people in that program. So all exciting. And lastly, I wanted to thank all of you. I think the vast majority of our commissioners were able to attend our February 8th Slow Health Counts Community Health Improvement Planning process. It was, I think, a real mix of an absolutely wonderful opportunity to get like-minded people and from all walks of our community health sector in the same room at the same time. We got a lot of feedback that the acoustics were awful, so we won't have tables sitting that close to each other the next time. But and also... you know, we're doing a lot of follow-up work because we really underestimated the passion and the multiple ideas and the disconnection from the data that might emerge from a day of that sort. And so we have been working with each of the group's leaders to come back together to really get us from all of the concepts and constructs that emerged from each of our eight groups that day into a coherent longer-term community health improvement plan. So stay tuned. Thank you to those of you who facilitated groups, but also especially to all of you who participated. And we'll get smarter with each time we come back together in terms of process. But a lot of really wonderful ideas and commitments came out of the day. So I'm very happy about where we're going from here. And that is the end of my report. Thanks.
Well, it was a very energetic day. I'm sure we would all agree on that. Thank you for putting that together for all of us. So let's entertain Health Commissioner updates. Susan, you want to start?
The HSOC Housing Committee meeting just met, and we're going to do a presentation next week working with the whole HSOC committee on a plan that the Board of Supervisors have asked as some short-term and kind of medium-term solutions or ideas around the housing crisis that we have. So we're working very diligently on that, and that presentation will go to the supervisors at their first meeting in May. And next month I'll give you the exact date.
An update on the Napoma Mesa air pollution issue. Running through it real quickly. The air pollution control district officer has charged the state parks with a violation of, I believe it's state health and safety rules, and has proposed a palette of possible solutions for different scenarios where state parks would close different areas and different numbers of acres of areas to ATV riding. It's kind of an odd proposal. It has then gone to the hearing board, which is independent of both the local political process and independent of the air pollution control district. It's a really good place for this to be, I think. And I understand that just this last week, the air pollution control officer and the state parks folks have come to a compromise solution that they're going to propose to the hearing board next Wednesday as a stipulated solution to this. I think it'll be very, very interesting to see what they come up with. And as I understand it, it'll be up to the hearing board to decide if that's an acceptable solution, in which case it will become official, or if it's unacceptable, then they have to continue in their adversarial process with witnesses and so forth, and then the hearing board will make a judgment on it. So it's been a real education for me in practical civics. And would you care to add anything to that, Penny? Yeah.
Sorry, I think you said where things are at the moment.
This is the one. Cough drop. This is one good shot at solving this problem, I think. So it might actually come out of this.
I attended the Opioid Safety Coalition meeting. I forgot my notes. But the takeaway that I remember is actually really positive news, which is that for the first time since 2012, our opioid overdose deaths have gone down. So that's excellent. And I think there's some other things. I don't know if Dr. Bornstein, do you remember anything else from that meeting?
Yeah, one thing that is just got launched last week is law enforcement agencies carrying naloxone.
Right.
So in concert with Emergency Medical Services Agency policy direction, I think it's the Sheriff's Department right now, and two others are in the process of going through Cal Poly Police Department, and I can't remember the third one.
Cuesta. Either
Grover or Morro Bay, or, sorry. But a number of law enforcement agencies are taking the template that was created by the Sheriff's Department and anticipate moving forward with that in the near term.
Yeah. Gina?
I don't have anything to report except to remind people that flu season is not over and come in and get flu vaccine.
Ditto on that. I have nothing to report.
I attended two meetings since the last time we got gathered, Adult Services Policy Council. There were some very interesting things that were presented. SINCAL made a presentation about non-emergency transportation. It's a big change, and it's always we have wonderful services, but actually getting people to the service is an issue. So it'll be coordinated in our county, and it's actually across into Santa Barbara County, but we will be covered at a call center, and then it'll be distributed so that the people get the rides they need. And then Kat Lauterbach, through the Department of Social Services, talked about CalFresh. These are some of the programs we might want to, they're new things available to people in our county, so it's nice to know what's available. Another thing that was really interesting was 211 was active, and it wasn't so active, and they did a presentation. They actually have someone hired, Monica Anderson from the United Way, about how it's online. A lot of good marketing as far as calling 211 if you have any issues, and they can link you up with the services. So you have transportation, and now you have all the services, and people can get the information they need. That's what I have to report.
Thank you. I had a couple of meetings. The Preventive Health Grant Community-Based Organization Grant Review Committee has been meeting. We made our final recommendations this morning. They'll add up the dollars and cents and know if we're over or if we're under and we need to adjust, and then those recommendations will go to the Board of Supervisors during their budget hearings in June. The Healthy Communities Work Group continues to meet monthly. We're actually pulling together some of our data and some of our figures so that we can report to the respective agencies out there about how many plans we've looked at, the things that we've kind of looked at, so you'll know what that's all about. Also, we're planning a more public meeting presentation in October, which I believe is Healthy Communities Month, as I recall. And undoubtedly, the Health Commission will be invited to be part of that. We'll have a speaker. We're going out to the communities to invite their planners and you know, really looking at health and all policies to allow us to have really healthy communities as far as that goes. And that is all that I have. Jean? I'm shutting your button off. So committee reports.
Over here.
Do we have any committee reports?
We're still looking for commissioners. We'll put that call out there once again. We're really in need of direct provider applicants. So if anybody is out there and would like to even think about joining us, we can convert you once we talk to you. So please access the application online and let us know about you. Prospective future items. I think we've pretty well planned everything. I actually, just on a side note, was approached by the chair of the Behavioral Health Board, I think it is, and wanted to know if we would consider at some time jointly meeting with them to see how we overlap, how we're separate and what have you. So I think we will talk about that as we plan, you know, accepted to everybody, as we plan for future meetings and what have you. Yes.
Actually, I attended a program, the Women's Commission for our county. Mm-hmm. Their special topic this year is health issues. So we really need to make sure we partner with them.
Okay.
So we can all work together.
Good idea. All right. Anybody have anything else? Thank you all for coming this evening, and we will see you next month, April the 9th, same time, same place.